Welcome, friends, it's the Movie Boom Podcast. Enjoy the show. Zachie and Brian are talking about movies. Movie Boom Podcast on the radio.
Welcome to Movie Film. This is 2018, and it's episode 139. My name is Zaki Hassan, and I'm joined by my partner, Brian Hall.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I mean, technically, this is our second new show of the new year.
Oh, that's right. E.T., that happened afterwards, huh?
It did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember,
yeah.
We were like, let's celebrate the 35th anniversary by missing the 35th anniversary.
Yeah. Just by about a week.
By a scotch.
Yeah,
but we are here. This is our first regular show of the new year, and I'm always excited when we start a new year on this show because I'm like, you know, it's always momentous because our first show back is always our best of the previous year. And I've mentioned in previous episodes that it's like rings on a tree trunk. Every time we do a best of show, it's like another year down, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and it's kind of fun looking back and. I don't know. It's fun looking back and remembering like, oh, that was from this past year.
That's right.
And not only that, but also whittling it down and sort of trying to evaluate like what. Like I try to write down the top 10 movies that meant the most to me.
Sure.
You know, not what I think necessarily were the best of the year. And so it's kind of a fun exercise going through that list and remembering things. You're like, oh, you know, I've forgotten about this, but this really meant a lot to me when I watched it. So it's
fun and you know I think it's worth getting into a little bit. What is your process of narrowing down that list? Because both you and I, we watch a substantial number of movies all year. How do you decide what makes the cut and in what order?
Well, what I do is I write down every movie I watch throughout the year. I have like a little document and it's just sort of this weird little, almost like journal entry thing that I just have gotten very used to doing.
Is it like a Doogie Howser thing where you watch the movie?
I don't actually write commentary anything with it, but I write down the date and the film.
If a giant monkey can save Brie Larson, maybe I can too. And like,
and then like Vinny pops his head in through the window. He's like, "Yo, dude, are we gonna go to the prom after all?" He's like, "You bet." And then grabs his jacket. And
I love that this is a reference. Like this is like deep cut time. I'm curious how many people will have no idea what the
which
hell
is kind mean. Of. Well, I was gonna say in a good way for Neil Patrick Harris. I mean, he's completely reinvented himself, and people know him. Strictly from other things now, but I mean, for us, he will always be Doog.
I wonder, do people still like come up to him on the street and call him Doogie?
It's probably just sad people our age.
That's really funny. Anyway, sorry, you were saying. So you keep a journal.
Well, so then I kind of can do like the easy cuts, you know, and then I whittle it down to the things that I remember, you know, I enjoyed the most, and then I don't know. I try to sort of find like finding an order, particularly this year, was sort of hard because it felt like some of them could easily be 1, 2, 3 or 3, 2. You know, they could be managed in different ways depending on my mood. But
yeah,
I just try to remember what were the most memorable experiences I had with each movie, and those are the ones that usually make it to the 10.
There we go. Well, there's a little peek behind Brian's curtain, if you know what I mean. very similar. I don't keep a scratch pad. I just kind of I go through my reviews for the year mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And because generally speaking, that you know those are the movies that have stuck out to me.
Yeah.
And and then it's just a matter of you know, you create like a top 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you start shuffling a little bit and eventually cutting down.
That's exactly right. So,
yeah.
But we'll get there. We'll get there in the second half of the show. Have you seen anything recently that, I guess, that you won't be talking about later in the show?
Yeah, it's funny. I on the ET commentary, I mentioned that I got sick on Christmas with the flu, which apparently was some sort of epidemic. I'm seeing news articles
all over the country.
Yeah, it was crazy. And E.T. was the first night that I was actually feeling better. And then literally the morning after, I got sick again.
Wow.
With something different. And, you know, did the whole urgent care thing and sweating in my bed and blowing my nose and coughing. It was terrible. So I was sick for a very long time. So I saw about 20 minutes of a lot of movies as I was fading in and out of sleep, which is kind of funny. But somewhere in between there, I managed to see Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which did we talk about this?
I talked about it. You had not seen it.
Yeah, sorry. I'm a little fuzzy on it. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun. It I didn't grow up with Jumanji. To this day, I still haven't seen it.
Uh-huh.
But it just looked like a fun, like a movie they don't seem to make anymore, like they used to make when we were kids, which is sort of, I talk about this sometimes, like that sort of PG adventure movie.
Right.
You know, that they, particularly in the 80s, used to do a lot. Or I guess like Jumanji in the 90s. But I really enjoyed it, more than I expected to, actually. I thought it was the characters, each were pretty interesting, and their sort of arcs all, you know, felt, they didn't feel shoehorned in just to have an excuse for special effects sequences, you know?
Doesn't it feel like the kind of movie that you put together in a laboratory? Where you're,
I
like,
mean, yes.
Take,
you know what?
Maybe take an IP, people know. Add Dwayne Johnson. You know?
Yeah. Kevin Hart worked well with him.
Right.
Yeah. Jack Black. People still, like, you know, laugh with Jack Black. Like, he's like,
he is like a safe great comedic. In this. He is really fun in this.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. Because even though this does seem like this was made using some sort of formula, it actually is fun and entertaining. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's well. You have like the formula going awry, which is Baywatch.
Oh yeah,
you know, and yeah. And then this is when it works. And by the way, this thing is a monster at the box office. It cost $90 million to make. It's already made about $300 million domestically, yeah. And it's looking at 700 something worldwide.
That is bonkers. I mean, clearly we're gonna get another one.
Yeah, and I'm curious about that. Like, if they do another one, do you just bring back all the same actors inside the game, you know?
Yeah, which is tough because that's what everyone enjoyed about this one, right?
Right.
But at the same time, what was fun about it was it, even though I haven't seen the original, it seemed like it was a fresh take while still feeling like it belonged in that universe.
Yeah, I mentioned this in our previous episode, but what I liked about it is that it does include the original movie.
Yeah, yeah. Which you, that I'm remembering this now, where you were saying even from like the opening of the movie, it links it directly.
Yeah, the first shot of this one is right where the last shot of the previous one left off. And even within the game, there's a reference to Alan Parrish, who's the Robin Williams character.
Mm.
'Cause Nick Jonas has been like stuck in the game forever, and he's like, oh, this is the house that Alan Parrish built.
So that's
a reference. You haven't seen it, so you wouldn't get that. But
yeah, but as I'm thinking about it now, even like it was a movie. As I'm thinking about the end,
yeah,
which I won't talk about. But I just remember that feeling that like good movies sort of give you, where you're like, man, I really went on a journey. I'm in it with these characters and feeling the feelings of sort of satisfaction and sort of like wistfulness over what just happened. And I was like, yeah, that's a good movie.
Yeah. There's a moment in the film where Colin Hanks shows up,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of smiles.
That's in particular what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Right? And he kind of smiles at the characters that we've been following. And that was where I was like, ah, that's nice. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I would recommend checking out the original one, if nothing else, just as a historical artifact.
Yeah, I mean, Robin Williams and Joe Johnston. And
my kids, they really liked, because I think I told you, we watched the original Jumanji, and then the next day we went and saw this one. So they, for them, it's just an interconnected whole. But I also bought them the Jumanji cartoon show, which I didn't know if you knew was a thing that existed.
No, but I guess it doesn't surprise me.
Right. That was like in the mid to late 90s. So I bought them that, and they love it, man. They're just blazing through it on DVD. So it's right in their wheelhouse, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. Anything?
I was just going to say, the only other complete movie I was able to see was I watched All the Money in the World.
Yes.
Which is the Paul Getty having his grandson kidnapped movie by Ridley Scott. And most notable, of course, because it originally starred Kevin Spacey, and then he was replaced in a matter of weeks by Christopher Plummer. And so, yeah, that's the gist of it, is Paul Getty, the richest man in the world in the 70s, has his grandson kidnapped, and his mother, who is divorced herself out of the family and doesn't have any of the money, goes to him asking if he will pay the ransom, and he says no. And that's the whole thrust of the movie. And so he has this fixer played by Mark Wahlberg, who's like, well, all right, I'll go get him, kind of a thing.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting because it's true.
Sure.
So there were, you know, I'm like, man, in a weird way, you can almost put yourself in these people's shoes a little more because it actually happened. But it, something about it just felt a little hollow.
Hmm.
It didn't have the emotional stakes you would expect. Even though Michelle Williams does a really good job as the kidnapped kid's mother. But she, I mean, when has she never not brought it, I guess?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I don't think the movie does her any favors and gives them the sort of downtime moments that you kind of need to really track with how they're feeling and what they're thinking. And it just sort of feels matter of fact.
That's a shame.
But yeah, but that said, and I didn't regret watching it, but I didn't really feel like it was vital either.
Okay.
But Christopher Plummer is easily the reason to watch this movie. I mean, he is captivating, and he's not even in it a ton, but he's peppered throughout, so his presence looms over the entire movie. I mean, he is the reason to watch this movie.
Okay.
So it's sort of fascinating knowing that the best thing about this movie happened in haste, maybe 3 weeks ago, you know.
That's fascinating.
So, yeah, if you end up catching it, I look forward to talking about it with you.
It's funny that they're doing a TV series about this exact subject matter.
Yeah, for FX with Danny Boyle, which I think is why they rushed it. Like, no, this movie has to come out now.
Yeah, that was the reason they did the 10-day reshoot. Yeah, it's the TV series stars Donald Sutherland as J. Paul Getty.
Yeah.
And Brendan Fraser as the Mark Wahlberg character.
And it looks like, I did, a lot of times when I watch true stories, I kind of go on Wikipedia or whatever, or I try to find articles, fact versus fiction.
Sure.
And it's funny, the Brendan Fraser portrayal I saw in the trailer seems a bit more accurate.
Oh, interesting.
But it was funny, it almost was like, you know, when you watch a movie like Last Action Hero, where Arnold Schwarzenegger goes into Bizarro World, and you see something you know, but portrayed with different actors,
right.
Like Stallone in The Terminator.
Right.
That's sort of what it felt like watching that trailer. I was like, I've already seen this, but why is Brendan Fraser in it? And why is Donald Sutherland in it?
This is like the Earth 2 version.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw the promo spots for this, and I'm just like, oh, Brendan Fraser's working.
I know. He's
good,
such a likable guy. Yeah. I'm
good
glad.
For him. You know.
That's funny.
That's what made me happy.
Yeah. How about yourself? See anything?
It has been kind of a light period. I was hoping in my break, which is about to end from school, I was like, oh, I'm gonna watch all kinds of stuff. But then you're like, oh wait, I have 5 kids. I don't have time. I don't have to, you know. I've got this movie pass that like is dangling in front of me as a reason to go to the theater. And yes, I think I'm going to the theater less somehow because I just don't have time.
What about with the screeners? Are there any that are still sitting on top of your Blu-ray player, like just calling your name?
Yeah, there's a few that I still need to get to. I mean, it's more than a few. I've got. It's a big old pile.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's just, I've mentioned this before, but it's like, I don't have time during the day. And then at night I come home and I'm just fried. And I want to go to bed, not watch movies.
Yeah. That's another thing. I don't know if we've really talked about this, but I have a friend who watches movies while on his phone.
Okay.
And I just can't do that. And he kind of half watches movies. And there's one movie in particular that he was like, I didn't really like it. And I was like, I loved it. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
And then in the back of my head, I was like, I wonder if he was on his phone. And then sure enough, it was a screener. And then sure enough, he went and saw it in the theater with a friend this weekend. And he's like, you know, that was pretty good. I was like, yeah.
When you watch it, when you watch it the way it's meant to be watched.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, my point being, you could throw it in while you're fried at night, but...
Yeah,
it's just it's hard to watch movies that you really want to see that way. You know, it's like you want to give them your full attention. And I know not everybody has those viewing habits, though.
That's really me. Yeah. So my schedule is not going to get any lighter in the next couple months. So somehow I just have to barrel through because, hey, we got a show to do, Brian.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want, like while you are falling asleep, I can, you know, you can put a little earbud in your ear, and I'll be like, and then Daniel Day-Lewis said as he threaded the dress.
No, I'll like hear it in my right. in my dream. I'll be like, I guess I watched that. That's really funny. Well, we got a couple of listener letters to knock out.
Yeah.
Some of them have been building up over a couple episodes, so I figured let's do that. And then if there's any brief headlines, we can discuss those. And then we'll do our annual best of 2017 list.
Cool.
Well, that's not an annual. It's our annual list, which this year will be best of 2017. We don't do best of 2017 every year. That would just be silly.
This is only the first year that it would actually make any sense.
It'll never again. Yeah. All right, here we go. This is a letter from Tyler Patrick, who is responding to our Star Wars The Last Jedi commentary. And I got to tell you, it's weird how nobody's talking about Star Wars The Last Jedi. It's like that movie just came and went and nobody discussed it at all.
Yeah.
He says, really enjoyed the Star Wars review and the Girl Meets World comparison. You're welcome. Here's my two quick ideas / thoughts. Do you think these will be better received if they were episodes 10, 11, and 12, and we had the films that show what is told to us in the backstory?
Mm.
That's something I've been talking about for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He says, also, I'm more interested now in the Lawrence Kasdan script / story he had worked on for episode 8 before Johnson took over. Really felt like they had the story laid out for the three films before The Force Awakens came out. Abrams said he would have liked to direct 9 and liked the story. It makes more sense why Trevorrow left for creative choices if Johnson changed it. Is that what happened, though? My understanding is Lawrence Kasdan laid out the story with J.J. Abrams, and then he was done after that. He didn't think past that.
That is my impression as well.
Yeah, I think his whole thing was I'll get the ball started and you guys figure it out, but I'm doing this Han Solo movie.
Yeah, and then he seems to be retiring from Star Wars.
Yeah, which I'll believe that when it happens.
Yeah, you kind of wonder if it was sort of an optics thing to have him working on Force Awakens, or if Abrams is like, hey, pal, you know, for 9. I don't know.
I doubt very much that Colin Trevorrow leaving had anything to do with what Rian Johnson did on this one. I think we've talked about this before. Like, there's this narrative that, like, Rian Johnson just snuck in under cover of night and, like, drew penises on people's faces and stuff while they were asleep. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, guys, all the same producers are in, like, Kathleen Kennedy is in charge of all of this, and she was okay with everything that he did.
Nobody's sneaking anything into this franchise.
you know, so it's very weird. Like, he undid everything that J.J. Abrams was setting up. It's like, well, J.J. Abrams is still involved as a producer. If he had qualms, I'm fairly certain he would have made them known.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Abrams was like, to a couple of those things.
Sure, but son of a bitch, you know?
Yeah. Well, I honestly don't even know. I mean, it's possible, but it doesn't mean that Rian Johnson got away with something. I mean, people knew what he was doing.
Here's what we do know. We know for a fact that the reveal of Rey's parents or lack of parents was something J.J. Abrams had planned independently on his own.
Yeah. Well, which, I mean, even I think you and I probably would have even come up with the same thing.
This is true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what makes the most sense, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like that's the thing that people are most pissed off about.
Yeah.
So,
which is, it's so funny. It's like the thing I'm least bothered me.
Yeah, you know, people, why isn't she related to Obi-Wan Kenobi? Or whatever? You know, like, it's always that.
Yeah.
It's funny I'm sure this is something we've covered before, but, like, the reveals that people wanted were almost all terrible.
Right, sure, yeah.
Like, they should have showed that Snoke is Darth Plagueis.
Right.
Why? You know, like, and you picture the version of that, child, do you know who I am? I'm Darth Plagueis. Like, what is her response going to be to that?
Who?
Yeah. Which is going to be the response of most people watching the movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, don't you remember in Revenge of the Sith, there's this scene where Palpatine is talking to Anakin in the opera, Darth Plagueis. What?
Yeah. You know, with the big bubble that looks like an egg and sperm swimming around it. And Come on, you've seen it.
So yeah, it's just funny because there's as I don't know if you saw this, some of these men's rights activists, they put together a 46 minute cut of The Last Jedi. Did you see this?
Yes, this is one of those things where I just sort of refuse to acknowledge these things.
Yeah, it's honestly, to me, all of the, between that and, like, there's a petition now that wants Rian Johnson to acknowledge that he ruined the franchise. That's another fun petition.
This is one of those things where I feel like when you were in high school or junior high and you talked about these movies and then some kid's like, oh yeah, well I made a version where I cut out all the women from the movie on my computer. And then you're like, okay, kid, you know what I mean? But like now that person has a mouthpiece to the world.
Right.
And that's the true. World needs content all day. So they're like, hey, some kid, da 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 da. And it's like, why are we even giving this kid a microphone?
Honestly, I feel like, the last 2 months, not even less than a month, a little over a month since the movie came out, of Star Wars fandom has been basically a hold my beer to all the overzealous DC Comics fans right. that I've like tossed tomatoes at for a while.
Yeah.
Because I'm just done with fans in general.
Yeah, I think I'm past that now. I certainly have my opinions because I'm a fan and it's fun to talk about them. And then move on.
Yes, right. I'm ready to move on, you know?
Yeah.
But before we move on, we still have some more The Last Jedi questions, right?
Yeah.
This is from Matt Ev. And this is in reference to our All Last Jedi episode. He says, man, this is great. There's enough material in The Last Jedi for you and Brian to do a regular All The Last Jedi All The Time podcast.
Oh, man.
Not that I'm suggesting you should do that. I, for one, would not complain if you did exactly that.
I really appreciate that, but I don't even know if I could do that.
Well, in a couple of years, if not sooner, we'll be doing a commentary track on that movie, Brian.
Yeah, and I look forward to it. We've talked about it. I mean, we've done kind of two episodes about it, really.
Yeah, we should just overlay our previous episodes over the movie. Be like, hit play now.
Well, I just mean that it's taken us two episodes to digest our feelings on it, you know, and to even compose them. And so it'll be interesting then a year or two or whatever it is when we eventually do that, like where we've landed.
Yeah. And you know, I've said to you before, and I say it now, that the joy for me is experiencing it through my kids. And, I was texting you about this earlier in the week that I bought, it was my oldest kid's birthday last week, so I got the boys an X-Wing fighter, a Poe Dameron X-Wing fighter specifically.
So the black and orange one?
It's the black and orange one, right. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is what else I've learned is that, they take all the same stuff and they just rebrand it for the new movie. So if you want the more affordable one, just buy the one from the previous movie because it's all being closed up.
That's funny.
So the X-Wing fighter from The Force Awakens, exactly the same thing from The Last Jedi, $20 I got it for.
Wow. So just a different box.
Just a different box. Yeah.
Yeah.
But my 4-year-old looks, and it comes packaged with the little Poe Dameron figure. My 4-year-old looks at it and he's like, Baba, Poe Ammon.
Aw.
And I'm like, how does he know Poe Dameron? Right. And he knows him because of his black hair. And I'm like, that's for kids. It's just, look, these are just more characters. And they're not like, oh, ew, I don't want to play with Darth Vader. They're like, hey, let's have, Finn fight Darth Vader. Like that's, you know.
Right.
It's mix and match.
Yeah.
It's plug and play. Pick your metaphor, whatever. Right? let the kids have it, you know?
Totally. And that is pretty cool that you have that perspective, you know? Because I think a lot of people don't.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. It's funny because my second, he's going to be 9 next week. He's like, when I get older, I want to pass these on to my kids. Hmm. He's talking about his Star Wars toys. And wow. I'm like, well, we'll see. <You know>? I just love that he's thinking that far ahead.
Yeah, that's really good. That's cool.
This is from Ben Herman, who says, agreed with everything you two had to say about Luke Skywalker. How the character is depicted in The Last Jedi is unexpected, but at the same time, it's more compelling and thought-provoking to me than how he was written in so much of the old pre-Disney expanded universe novels and comics where the character was not really allowed to grow or change all that much. And I certainly think Mark Hamill did an amazing job with the material.
Hmm.
And that's something, I mean, we've talked about it before, but I mean, the characters, the main Star Wars characters were frozen in amber.
Yes.
For the majority of, you know, from 1991 to 2014 or whenever they got rid of the expanded universe. And that's a hard hill to climb. That's a bitter pill, mm-hmm. et cetera. And that's what people are having a hard time dealing with. And it's funny because I certainly have very passionate expanded universe defenders on my Facebook who I'm not going to dispute their love of that material. Cause yeah, I get it. You did, you know, invested decades into it. But they're like, you know, Luke got married and this happened and then this, and I'm like, yeah, but fundamentally you knew nothing was ever seriously going to happen to Luke. You knew Luke was quote unquote safe. You knew Han Solo was quote unquote safe.
Mm.
And that's something you can do in licensed fiction that doesn't really need to be followed up on. Right. But when we live in a real world where people do age and get older and you have to shuffle those characters off, well, things change.
Right.
You know, it is interesting that Leland Chi, who is a Lucasfilm employee, who is sort of in charge of maintaining continuity both before and after Disney, he said one of the reasons in his mind that they did sort of decertify the expanded universe and move in a different direction was because in the novels, they had killed off Chewbacca.
Right. Right.
And this was a bridge too far if you're going to keep doing the movies.
Yeah, I mean, there was no way you kickstart Star Wars again and not have Chewbacca in it.
Not have Chewbacca, right? Like, and I remember, Brian, I remember saying this on our show way back in 2012. Folks, go back and listen to the archives. I was like, Chewbacca wow. is dead. In how do you get around that?
Yeah.
That's a problem, right? You can't be like, hey, Han Solo's back. Where's Chewie? Oh, well, in a novel 13 years ago, a moon fell on him.
Right. That's which not, is true. You're not making that up.
That's a real thing that happened, but nobody's going to be happy with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I mean, it just stands to reason you can't make these new movies contingent on reams and reams of material. I mean, there's no doubting just how much stuff they created.
Oh yeah.
It's astonishing, right? And I have to imagine that if you're a fan who really dug into that and invested your emotional capital in that reality, to be told none of that matters, and then you're presented with something that in your mind is inferior. I mean, yeah, I guess that's tough. I mean,
I'm
sympathetic, you know.
Yeah,
but I do feel like at some point you say, hey, it's fiction.
right.
I'm always reminded of William Shatner hosting Saturday Night Live, where he says, It's just a TV show. right. Just get a life, will you? Look at you. You must be almost 30. You ever kissed a girl?
Yeah.
That's what I say to all these people, Brian. Have you ever kissed a girl? Or boy?
And liked it? Da, da, da.
Anyway. I'm thinking of the interview now with Kim Jong-un and Katy Perry.
I saw that the majority of it while I was sick.
Oh, really?
Like TBS, unfortunately, had commercials and stuff.
But, does it? Oh my gosh! What is that movie like on TBS?
Cable's like kind of changed quite a bit. Like they don't cut as many curse words as they used to, and
really
and whatnot. Yeah, but I don't know. I actually enjoyed that movie. I remember when it came out, it had like people didn't like it at all because it had been built up as it's like your civic duty to watch this movie, right? You know, after all that happened, you know, internationally, and President Obama even like had to address the film. And I don't know, I just sort of saw it for what it was, and I was like, that's fun.
Yeah. It's a movie it's grown in my estimation. Actually, I teach a class called Cultural Expression in Media, and it's a series of screenings over the course of the semester, and that's the first movie that I show.
Oh, funny. Yeah. So yeah.
I've incorporated it.
Makes me giggle.
It's very Rogan Franco.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
I think that's one of those things that you either like or you don't, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And I know a lot of people don't, but
there you go.
I do.
Those people are wrong, Brian. But moving on. This is from Rob Kelly in reference to our ET commentary track. And he says, very much enjoyed this. I saw E.T. in its original release, and while I liked it at the time and played the hell out of the video game over at Darren Fleischman's house. How's wow. Darren doing these days? It just never struck a chord with me the way it did lots of other kids, specifically Brian, obviously, even though... he's almost always a positive voice on the show, he was positively beaming during the commentary, which was a pleasure to listen to. That's nice. Yeah. This is Rob continuing. He says, I remember when Jurassic Park came out, and after it eventually passed E.T. as the number one box office champ, even Kathleen Kennedy admitted she was a little sorry because, quote, E.T. is such a special film. That's kind of interesting. And he says, finally, the discussion of the novelization and possible sequels. By the way, I didn't realize that the sequel books that you discussed, Brian, are from like the early 2000s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're far after the movie.
Oh, there's one. I remember one from the 80s. Or maybe that's just my memory, but I remember my neighbor having one. And okay. I was thinking, like, the adventure continues?
Interesting. Yeah, but certainly the William Kotzwinkel book that you talked about was from, like, it was tying in with the 20th anniversary.
Oh, interesting.
So, go figure.
Yeah.
This is Rob. He says, I wonder why you didn't mention these other 80s directors' treatments for possible E.T. sequels, and one of them is E.T. 2, Southern Comfort by Walter Hill. Or E.T. 2, Ninja Domination, and E.T. 3, Keys, Missing in Action. That would be from Golan Globus.
I imagine the ninja one would look a lot like at the end of the 1990 Ninja Turtles movie when Splinter has the nunchucks and throws Shredder. So it's like you have to do this really creative cutting to make it look like this really stiff puppet is like doing this action.
I like the Keys Missing in Action. I'd watch the hell out of that movie.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I would too. That'd be awesome.
And then E.T. 2, Weird Science Fiction, directed by John Hughes. I love Rob's like sequel suggestions. They're always really funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And his podcast is great too. We should plug that. Fire, Film and Water, right?
Film and Water, not Fire and Fury. That's it.
Yes. Yeah.
And Rob, by the way, is launching the all new MASHcast. Which is coming at the end of next month, and I love the sequence of events here where we started with like you and I discussing MASH the movie on our show,
all because I was flipping channels at 11 at night on a work night and saw MASH on HBO and was like, I've never seen this. That's the only reason we ever talked about it.
Yeah, so that conversation with you got me talking about the show. And then Rob reached out to both of us and was like, hey, come talk about MASH the movie on my show, you know, the Film and Water show. And then meanwhile, separately, I watched the movie because of talking to you, and that got me into the show again. And I'm like up to the sixth season with my son, who I'm going through it with. And he loves it. He's like, hey, can we watch MASH? Which is weird. Because I'm like, don't.
In 2017.
In 2017, an 11-year-old is like, can we watch MASH, right? Which I'm like, don't tell your friends that because they might give you a wedgie or something. I ended up going on Rob's show and doing a whole episode about the MASH TV show. That lit the fire that was already there for him to do the MASH cast. Meanwhile, circle back around to me, last week I spent an hour talking to Mike Farrell, a.k.a. BJ Honeycutt, for... a special episode of the Nostalgia Theater Show coming next month.
Wow. Unreal. I cannot wait to listen to that.
That's a fun one. But all this because Brian Hall was channel surfing one day.
And I almost didn't mention it. I remember it was totally like, and I watched MASH. It's crazy.
You gotta love it.
Yeah.
It's synchronicity. I don't know what else you call it. Well, with that in mind, let's take a little break, and then we'll come back and talk about our favorite movies of the year that just ended. All right. And we're back, and 2017 is over, which means the time has come once again, Brian, to take stock of our favorite film picks.
I know, I can't believe it's that time. But I always do enjoy looking back.
So. It's good to look back. Just don't stare. It's good advice. I just got last year. We usually do. You know, we run through. You say your 10. I say my 10. You say your 9. I say my 9, etc. Do we want to do like a brief honorable mentions before we get to the nitty gritty?
Yeah. Let's do that.
Proceed, Governor.
Okay. This was like an interesting year, whereas I felt like there were certain movies that cemented themselves into my top 10, and there were other ones where I had to really sort of reflect back on the viewing experience and be like, you know, I feel like this one should go here, but really it's probably more this one.
Yeah.
So the ones that, you know, came close but didn't make the cut were Dunkirk.
Okay.
Which I would really like to revisit. I really did like that movie a lot, and I really appreciated the sort of poetic nature of the storytelling, that, you know, the way that he tried to portray this, the three, you know, varying timelines and senses of urgency in different spaces and time. I'd really, really love to go back to that one. Shape of Water, which I'd really love to talk about that movie with you sometime and just really get into it. I really enjoyed it, but I didn't get I didn't fall in love with it like a lot of people seem to have, even though I did really enjoy it. So yes. I'd love to like kind of get into the nitty gritty about that at some point.
Yeah, my response to that film is very similar to yours, actually, and that is in fact also in my honorable mentions.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. There we go. Spider-Man: Homecoming, which I had a lot of fun with, but didn't crack the 10. The Post, which was close. I think we'll get in that one probably a little bit later. Lady Bird, the Greta Gerwig film.
I have that in my honorable also.
Oh, really? Yeah. Another one that like I really enjoyed, but it was just, you know, cracking the personal Brian 10. It was knocking on the door. It was very, very close. And it's welcome to come in anytime.
Saoirse Ronan is fantastic in that movie.
Yeah, and just the way that, just to mention it briefly, just the way that it handles a year in the life of someone so elegantly is also really great. And it doesn't even try to explain everything that's happening. It sort of lets you just pick up on what's going down, and it does it in a way that is just really well executed. That's good. That's a good one. I feel kind of crazy for putting this here, but I'm like, I really did dig this movie, Atomic Blonde.
Oh, sure.
Just for an action film that I feel like I saw a trailer like every other day somehow for this movie building up to it. And then it came out and it didn't really make much of a splash. And I eventually caught it on streaming. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was like a really solid action movie, and actually had a great lead character who was interesting and not just a cipher for action sequences. And the action sequences themselves were handled in a really cool way that I tend to enjoy. And I talk about this a lot, particularly, I think, on the Raiders of the Lost Ark commentary, where you put someone in a room and you use everything in the room, you know, and it's not like all these things are flying in and they're pulling stuff out of their, you know, jacket pockets that don't make sense and whatever. It's like using your resources to make a really inventive action sequence. And I thought that this movie had that in spades, and it was a fun watch for me. So that's for me.
Those are your honorables. Well, you mentioned two of mine, Lady Bird and Shape of Water. In addition to that, for me, I put Baby Driver, which I liked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just barely missed the cut for me. Wonder Woman, I liked a lot. Again, the fact that these did not make the top 10 should not be construed as a qualitative judgment. Logan, which that's a movie that it's just a showpiece performance by both Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
The film itself is very, it's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that it makes you feel uncomfortable, and I think, I mean, by design. So really you have to look at it as almost like an indie, like a character study, and it works exceptionally well on that level.
Yeah.
And Thor Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
missed it by that much. You know, I
totally
that was just a whole lot of fun, and that almost made the cut for me, but I ended up not putting it in my top 10.
Nice, all good stuff.
Hopefully, and now let's get into the actual rankings.
Yeah,
what's your number 10, Brian?
Number 10 for me. And this was a juggling act between Dunkirk, actually. Mm-hmm. But I had to go with The Disaster Artist.
Oh, okay. Nice.
And the reason for that is kind of a personal one. But I, being someone who moved out here from the Midwest to get into entertainment, I couldn't help but see a little bit of myself in this movie and really place myself into it and sort of go along for the ride. And, you know, down to... I mean, they portray the sort of, let's do this scary drive to L.A. Like, I'm going to attempt this. And I really respond to that. And then also the how does this work? Like, I'm here. I want to do this. Now what? Kind of a thing. And then eventually, of course, the movie is basically them saying, screw it. We'll do it ourselves.
Right.
Which is something, of course, I and my friends attempted, but never on this scale. Right. And the fact that these guys had the gumption to just go for it and to create something that collided with my LA experience. Like, I remember the billboard for this movie, and I remember catching wind of, you know, you got to check this thing out, and then going to see it and having my own personal experience with it and getting to see the behind the scenes story of this, which is really about the passion of, you know, creative people. And I feel like, I don't feel like the film is mocking these people or mocking the film. I think it's just trying to study where they were coming from and say, and this thing didn't work out, but in a way it kind of did. Like, it became a thing that people enjoy. And so there was a lot for me to sort of connect with on this. So that Disaster Artist is my number 10.
Yeah, I'm just going to echo everything you said and say that it made my list too, but a little higher than yours.
Nice.
So just add a ditto to everything you said about that movie.
Sure.
Number 10 for me is Kong Skull Island.
Nice.
Which is not a movie I expected to like, much less love. And I remember very distinctly seeing the first trailer or the Comic-Con trailer, whatever it was, with you. I was in L.A. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, eh, all right, I guess.
Sure.
And why? Because you know, we've talked before, you know, you feel old when you watch some of these things with these CGI monsters, and you just like, I don't feel any connection to any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching Kong Skull Island made me feel young.
Huh.
And that's why I loved it. It made me feel like that 8-year-old kid who would stay home on you know, weekends and watch, you know, the monster matinee on WPWR TV or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I loved about it. And I think it plays straight with itself, but it also has a lot of fun. And I think that's why I liked it a little more than the 2014 Godzilla, which I felt like was a little too self-serious.
Yeah, sure.
This one remembered to have some fun, and I mean, this is a movie that I pop on all the time, and I can watch King Kong just fighting these monsters all the live long day. I think it's just so much fun. But beyond that, I could watch John C. Reilly's character completely separate from a King Kong movie all the live right. long day, you know?
Right.
So I certainly didn't expect at the beginning of the year that this was a movie that I would keep watching.
Mm-hmm.
And that says something about how it stayed sort of in the periphery of my memory.
Nice.
Yeah. So what's your number 9?
Number 9 for me, Phantom Thread.
Which I have not seen. So that's a gap in my viewing experience.
Yeah, well, I really love Paul Thomas Anderson, but I've had a complicated relationship with him in the past few years. And
sure.
I really like Boogie Nights. Crazy enough, I've never seen Magnolia, which I know is kind of a cornerstone picture for him and for a lot of his
fans. Pretty polarizing.
Yeah, but I, you know, Punch Drunk Love, and I just really love his style. I'm really taken with it. But then I wasn't as taken with The Master.
Yes.
I thought it was an interesting character study, but as a movie, I walked out a little frustrated by the experience and
sure.
sort of like, what was that? Right. And then Inherent Vice to me is impenetrable.
Right.
And I mean, I feel like he owes me a Coke because I ended up watching the whole thing. So Phantom Thread, I was actually a little hesitant about it, and it looks stuffy, and it was with trepidation I actually watched it. But I still was like, but I really love what he does, and I'm sure it'll be, you know, great to look at. And turns out I really enjoyed this movie a lot. And I think what it is it takes the best of all the things that he does. Like, he is really good with intentional pacing, which you could translate into slow.
Right. Right.
but when done well, I would call it intentionally paced. And I think this is a lush film where he really does move at a slower clip, but it's so you can immerse yourself in this movie. And what the movie has going for it is these two really strong characters, and there are other strong characters as well, but the two main characters, one, you know, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, and unfortunately I don't have the other one in front of me, the woman, she is fantastic, totally a find. But it's about their romantic relationship, and he's this super fussy dressmaker who is a genius and not a horrible person, but fussy.
Sure.
And in watching their relationship, where she sort of challenges him, and you're kind of questioning, does he love her or does he just love having someone around? And it's where some movies you would just sort of, you know, like, do I care? I feel like this movie felt like a really wonderful book, where books can sort of take their time in the slower moments, but having those slower moments make the characters richer for it. And then make why this movie is great is because it isn't just sort of a, let's just spend 2 hours with these characters and just drop off and you're going to appreciate it. This actually does have a story to tell, and it does have a satisfying conclusion, which I think was missing from his last two movies, in my opinion.
Do you feel that this is a worthy capstone to Daniel Day-Lewis's career, if assuming he does in fact retire after this?
I mean, it's hard to say. It's hard to say, like, yes, I, Brian Hall, believe this is the part. But yeah, I think he does a really wonderful job playing a really complicated person that you're not sure how you feel about. Hmm. And but when the movie was all said, I was with it the whole way, and I was willing to just go, like, okay, I'll just spend time with these two people, and then I'll just hop out of this world. But then it actually did conjure up a really interesting story. I was like, oh, wow. And I found myself really satisfied with the experience when it was over.
Nice. So Phantom Thread, that's something that I can look forward to seeing.
Yeah, I think so.
Number 9 for me is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
Is this one that you had a chance to see?
Yeah, and actually it's going to be appearing shortly.
Oh, okay, great. So, well, you know what? I'll hold off this conversation then until we get to it later on.
Okay, well then do you want to go ahead to your next one? And then I'll...
Number 8 for me was A Ghost Story.
Yeah, I've been wanting to see this.
So this is, man, I really want to get your take on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier in the year when I saw it that the screening ended, and this is a movie that almost defies you to sit through it. I mean, we have basically a real-time sequence of Rooney Mara eating a pie.
Yeah, I've heard this.
Yeah, so that's one of those things where... like, you can imagine people, like, if you look around at that moment, people will be, like, twitching and, like, sweating and, like, not knowing what to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's an episode of Community where they have a group of people gathered for a study, but the study is actually making them wait for the study to start.
Yeah.
And Donald Glover, like, when he breaks, he just breaks spectacularly. And I feel like that's this sequence where Rooney Mara eats the pie. This is not just about Rooney Mara eating a pie, of course, but I think it is this amazing reflection on the nature of mortality, the nature of existence, really, not even mortality. Mm-hmm. And I said this at the time that the movie ended, and I was like, I think I hated that.
Hmm.
And then I this was in Berkeley, and I drove home, and I walk into the house, and my wife's like, what'd you think of the movie? And I'm like, I think I loved it.
Huh.
So it took that 45-minute drive to you know, sort of get my thoughts in order.
Isn't that great? I mean, that's a movie that lingered then. It got under your skin.
It did, yeah. And it's not for everybody. It really is not. I do think you will like it. That's my, I'm putting my chip down on that.
I have a feeling. Yeah, it's one of those ones that sort of eluded me. It came out, I think, at sort of an awkward time.
Yeah.
Of the year, and I know you got to see it because and you spoke to the director. That's in.
That's right, David Lowery. Episode. Yeah, that's one of our previous episodes. Yeah, you know, I said before that it's like a film school activity where you're like, okay, make a movie about what happens when somebody dies, and one person comes up with you know, a ghost. With Patrick Swayze, and then one person comes up with a ghost story.
Right. Wow, that's a really yeah. And then you know those are the two that are going to make it.
That's right. That's right. So it is absolutely worth watching. It stayed with me in a profound way, and I have a feeling you'll enjoy it too, Brian.
Great.
What was your number 8?
Well, before I get to that, I wasn't super prepared here. I have my list, but I have to call out Vicky Creep. Crepes or Creeps?
Yeah, sorry, I was going to mention that. Yeah,
Phantom Thread, unbelievable. Like we're going to be seeing a lot more of her. I have a feeling, so I just had to call her out. Number 8 for me is Get Out.
Oh, nice.
And that's one I feel like we'll probably be talking about. So should I hold off on that?
Yeah, let's. that does appear slightly later on my list.
All right. Well, then I can move on to my number 7 because we can talk about this now, which was Three Billboards.
Nice.
Yeah, so here, let me hear your thoughts.
Well, it's weird how this movie has become kind of polarizing.
Yes.
Like a lot of people embraced it loudly early on, and then there was kind of the backlash.
Yes.
And if I'm honest, I don't entirely understand the backlash because I just found it very poignant, and I found it very thoughtful, and I thought it's this very small movie about these very flawed characters,
mm-hmm.
who I enjoyed seeing their journey. I think that it's a performance film. I mean, you've got three really strong performances: Frances McDormand as the main character, Sam Rockwell as I suppose we would consider him an antagonist of sorts,
mm-hmm.
And Woody Harrelson, who is not really getting mentioned as much.
Yeah.
But who I feel is like the beating heart of this movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He's, I mean, with characters who are at odds with each other, he's in between all of it.
Right. And you know, the it's called Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, because Frances McDormand plays a woman whose daughter was raped and murdered. And she's so frustrated by the lack of any sort of progress in finding out who did this, that there are these three billboards that she buys advertising space on them, essentially questioning the sheriff in this town. Why aren't you doing anything about this, sheriff?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where the drama of the film starts, as you have this town that's at odds with, you know, the respect they have for the sheriff, Woody Harrelson, and trying to be sensitive to this mother's loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, it's not, there's no like high stakes drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that. It's an internal story. And so I think the fact that they're able to make you feel so much with what is really an internal story, that says something.
Yeah. I think when I started it, I thought it was going to be an angry movie.
Yes. Yes.
And
right.
I wasn't prepared to watch an angry movie. And I think the reason for that is there's a lot to be angry about in the world right now, and people's behaviors and wanting things to change. And sometimes angry movies, because they have to really hit the nail on the head when they portray these things, they can be a little overwrought. And I felt like that was what I was stepping into. And so it was, to my surprise, what really hooked me with this movie eventually and really, you know, got its claws into me, is it's a movie about angry people learning to be less angry and to sort of, in particular, I mean, Sam Rockwell's character, who has been troublesome for many, I feel like he's not a good person.
Right.
But this movie is him going to his lowest point and seeing if he can be a good person. And it's the baby steps. We're only seeing the first step.
That's right. And I think that's a crucial thing because he is really vile.
Yes.
And I think people question, like, oh, so are we supposed to like him at the end of the movie? And I'm like, I don't think that's what the movie's saying.
No, he's not there yet. And he's the movie, it's hard to not really talk about, but the movie doesn't leave you in a necessarily everything's wrapped up great place.
Yes.
You know, it's so I that's why I'm sort of like, I hope he gets there. But it was, I really enjoyed the journey of this horrible person showing glimmers of hope that, yeah, he could, even the worst of people could maybe reflect a little bit and think that they want to be a different person. Like, there's a scene between him and the guy that sells, well, let's say the relationship between him and the guy that sells the billboard.
Yes.
To Frances McDormand's character. And it almost brought me to tears.
Yes, absolutely.
I almost want to talk about it, like, specifically. I won't, but he has a horrible interaction with this person, and then, you know, there's a second interaction, and it almost brought me to tears.
Yes.
And that's when I knew the movie, I really admired what the movie was trying to do.
Well, and also, Brian, I mean, Frances McDormand is, like, she's not the conscience of the movie.
She's not a great person.
She's not. And there's a scene where she goes on a date with Peter Dinklage.
Yes.
That kind of breaks your heart a little bit, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because Peter Dinklage is a character in the film who you end up just really liking him.
Yeah.
And he's treated very badly, I would say.
Yeah.
Right. And this movie is written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who is English, you know, and I think the fact that he brought, he really zeroed in on what feels like a very quintessentially American story says something about his skills also.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Three Billboards. So that's that was your number seven.
Number seven.
My number seven was The Disaster Artist, which we already covered. So I won't add too much. I found it just delightful. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But my number six is Get Out.
Hey, let's talk about it. Get Out.
So this one I saw much later, like after most of the hype had died down. And to some extent that was almost like a handicap going in because I'd already heard all the great stuff about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost more impressive that I liked it as much as I did after that.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote in my write up that Rose, give me the keys is like the most terrifying part of this movie for me.
Oh yeah,
because it's that realization of the walls closing in on you and what you thought of as safe harbor is not in fact safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And it is chilling. I think it works on so many levels, but I think what really struck me most more than anything is that this is the first movie that Jordan Peele ever made.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like a lightning bolt debut. I can't think of a stronger debut from a more unexpected source. I mean, this is not to say that Jordan Peele is not immensely talented, but we think of him in sort of being this little box, right? The sketch comedy box. But this movie is scary and insightful and intelligent, mm-hmm. and it works on all of those levels, you know?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a juggling act. I mean, it's like you said, it's chilling and it nails the chills. It's also funny,
yes,
at times, and it nails the comedy without it becoming you sort of losing the thread of the seriousness that it's also handling. And it's like a mystery, and it's all these things, and you can't believe how perfectly balanced and executed all of those things are to put together this crazy, crazy movie. I mean, when you try to describe this movie out loud, the whole thing from beginning to end, you're like, I hope it works.
Yeah.
And the fact that it completely does is amazing.
It's funny because it's definitely one of those movies that even after all the hype, I truly did not know about it. Like I hadn't delved into the mystery box.
Ah.
And I'm grateful for that because I think it really does work best when you have no idea what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had recommended it to my brother, and he, for whatever reason, he like read up on it. So he's like, so at the end of Get Out, like, this is the thing that I'm like, what? Why? What'd you do? I'm like, what'd you do? He's like, well, I read about it. I'm like, well, why'd you?
Yeah.
You know, like, what a strange thing to do, because I think that the twists work so much better if they are actual twists.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I also think, you know, we have to give a lot of credit here to the casting. You know, like when you look at somebody like Bradley Whitford, who's known, his persona on screen and off is sort of being like a liberal firebrand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this movie really juxtaposes that with like the seedy underbelly of white liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that works especially well given what the subject matter of the film is.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually, while I was sick, I caught the last say 45 minutes of it on HBO and I was like, man, it just hooked me in again.
Yeah. It's definitely a movie with layers. Well, where multiple viewings reveal a lot of subtleties that you might not have caught necessarily the first time.
Yeah.
So that was my, what was that? That was my number six.
All right. Well, number six for me was Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
Hey, and since we have not talked about this movie at all,
yeah.
let's just launch into it.
Do you want to wait? Is this coming up or?
It is coming up, but I mean, do we have anything further we can really say about this?
Well, all I'll say about it making, because we've talked about it in the show, but you know, I had complicated feelings about it when I first walked out of it, and I've since seen it three times, and it isn't higher on my list like, you know, I might have expected, but at the same time, it is a movie that completely had me.
Yes.
And I still have quibbles. I'll probably always have quibbles with a few of the things, but I've learned to calibrate to what it is that they set out to do. And, I still am, I don't know if it's unfair because of my history with the movies or, you know, the series, but like, I just am, I'm in. And so this was certainly one of the most memorable and, in spite of all those other things, enjoyable movie experiences I had this year, for sure. Well, seeing Luke Skywalker stare down a bunch of AT-AT walkers.
Come on.
You know, lightsaber drawn. I mean,
that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. So.
So that was your number six, you said?
Yeah.
All right. Number five for me is Blade Runner 2049.
Whoa, me too.
Is that your number five?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about it.
Well, this, I think it just came out on Blu-ray, and I think it's one of the few I don't buy Blu-rays much anymore, and this is one I imagine I will probably pick up because I really want to watch it again, and I really want to get into the behind-the-scenes stuff. But, which I don't do as much these days. I don't have time for this, but there's certain movies where I'm like, I want to live in this a little bit longer, you know?
Yeah.
And that's probably the perfect way to describe it. I mean, this is a movie I just wanted to, I did live in while I was watching it. And to go back to a phrasing, deliberately paced for sure, but it's also completely immersive as a world and as a mystery and as an experience. And I was on board and riveted with it the entire way through. And as long as it was one I wasn't ready to leave. So, it was a great experience for me.
Yeah. You know, I it's astonishing to me that this is 3 years in a row that a Denny Villeneuve movie is in my top 10. And I think that just shows how remarkably consistent he is.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of the quality, but at that level where he's making a movie every year and it's a great movie every year.
Yeah.
It really says something about his particular skill set and his ability to really create worlds. The fact that he moved into Ridley Scott's neighborhood, mm-hmm. and you know, he didn't gentrify it.
You mm-hmm. know? Yep.
He added to it and he expanded on it and he made a beautiful film that stands apart along with standing alongside the first one. And I think that's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I said when we talked about this movie before that I really I don't feel the need to ever go back to the Blade Runner universe, and that's not because I dislike these movies, but I just feel like between the first one and the second one, I think they've said everything they need to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And these, it's like, we don't have to keep going back. I get to revisit these, you know?
That's right. Yeah. So, well, number five for both of us.
Yeah, it's funny.
Number four for me was War for the Planet of the Apes.
Nice.
And this is a movie that, I mean, I don't need to say much more about. I think that it's an achievement. This trilogy is an achievement. I think it will, with the passage of time, be viewed as among the best trilogies ever made.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that goes to Andy Serkis creating this character alongside the effects wizards. I mean, he created a character that could not have existed 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just the we weren't there yet, you know, and yet we're at a place now where War for the Planet of the Apes ends and we've reached the end of a journey with Caesar, and it's draining. It's emotionally draining.
Mm-hmm.
Because we feel such a kinship with him. I mean, it's extraordinary, you know. I'm disappointed that the movie didn't do better, but I have a feeling that its reputation will be sustained over time.
Yeah, and in particular, you being the super fan that you are of the series, it's really awesome that you, a lot of times the third film is like the,
yeah.
You know, and it's really awesome that for you the whole series just really nailed it for you.
It did, and you know, I've said before, like, if this is the end of the series, hey, that's fine. You know, it's a decent ending. I hope they find ways of keeping on going because I love, you know, visiting this franchise. But you know, they went out with their boots on. You know, so that's my number four. What's your number three? Or wait, did you do? No, you haven't done your number four. Sorry.
Number four, actually, and it just as a little footnote, I just have to mention it. I watched last night. I was doing laundry, and I just needed something that was like an hour long to sort of occupy my mind while I was doing the dryer or whatever. And I watched The Beginning, that Star Wars documentary from the Phantom Menace DVD.
Oh, that's great.
It's a great, and I highly recommend people check it out. It's on YouTube, and it's interesting because it's a fly on the wall, sort of warts and all, look at beginning to end the making of the Phantom Menace. And one of the aspects, of course, is Jar Jar, and how are they going to handle him as a fully realized CG character? Or are they? It first begins where the actor was going to wear a suit and just his head was going to be digital. And as they go through this documentary, they sort of realize, well, it's kind of easier and actually cheaper to make a full CG character. And Lucas is like, okay. And then at one point it shows them using very early form of motion capture where there's only like a couple ping pong balls on Ahmed Best.
Right.
And Lucas is like, well, we really need to get this right and figure it out and how to make it cost effective because this could change everything.
Right.
And he's saying that in the moment, like they're capturing him realizing this. And when you said that Caesar is a character that could not have existed 15 years ago, it's totally true. And it's kind of funny then that I just happened to see this documentary that was about them pioneering this, inventing it as they go.
Yeah, it's
look at where we're at now.
It's sad in a way that to some extent, you know, the road that began with Jar Jar paved over Ahmed Best.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, because Andy Serkis is sort of, and rightly so, I would say, credited for really being a revolutionary in this area. But yeah, it started with Jar Jar Binks, and that's sort of the uncomfortable, you know, reality.
Yeah, that is a little unfortunate for him. He deserves, I don't know, hopefully he has his sort of moment down the line when people reevaluate everything. And
one hopes.
Yeah. So anyway, for me, number four was Wonder Woman.
Nice.
And I think this was my favorite popcorn film of the year. And the reason for that is, and I say this, and I don't say this with disdain. I don't know how to say it without it sounding that way. But like the superhero films, I always enjoy watching them, but they are starting to blur a little bit to me. And they make me feel good while I'm watching them, but I tend not to revisit them.
Right.
Excuse me. Like I'll always revisit 89 Batman and I'll always revisit The Dark Knight. But the superhero movies now, maybe because they're coming so fast and furious and maybe because I don't know. But I don't tend to revisit them. But Wonder Woman I saw in a theater twice this year and I enjoyed it maybe even more the second time, even though I totally enjoyed it the first time. And I think why I like it so much is because it really it didn't hit the ABC beats you expected necessarily, or maybe it did, but it did it so well it didn't feel like it. And it succeeds in being a fish out of water movie, a relationship movie that I totally enjoyed and bought into. And it has action that I thought was memorable and serviced the plot in a way that really wasn't just fun to watch, but it felt important to what was happening. You know, and when I left it, you know, I left the movie with a character that I couldn't wait to spend more time with. So, yeah, Wonder Woman to me was, I think, for me, the strongest sort of popcorn movie of the year.
You know, I think that the No Man's Land sequence, where she first makes her debut as Wonder Woman in the film, is so effective that it's it's among the best in this genre, like, that we've ever seen.
Right.
And I pop that sequence on all the time. And one thing that I'm always struck by is, I don't know if a director other than Patty Jenkins could have achieved the same effect, because it's devoid of the male gaze.
Mm-hmm.
She's not sexualized even while wearing this inherently sexy outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And that says something about her skills as a director.
And this is no slam, but it did become apparent when we watched Justice League.
Yes, very much. You're right.
I noticed her outfit in a completely, like, not even intentionally, but just the way the camera was capturing her. I was like, oh, I don't remember her shorts being that short. Right. And I just had these, like, little moments, and I was like, oh, well, because it was captured differently.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So... yeah, like I said, I mean, that made my honorable mentions list.
Yeah.
So that was your number four, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number three for me, Dunkirk.
Hey.
I guess I liked it a little more than you did.
Yeah, I do want to revisit it. But yeah, let's hear it.
I revisited this just recently via 4K Ultra HD, which is like the perfect way to watch Christopher Nolan movies.
Yeah, I bet.
And... you know, the stuff I said earlier in the year still applies, or late last year, I should say. It's a portrait of war that I've never seen depicted quite this way, and that's what really, like, the juxtaposition of timelines and the very scattershot storytelling, to me, just added to the sense of despair that one has in these scenarios. And I think... you know, the moment that I'm always that remains in my memory is when Cillian Murphy, who is just despairing about having to go back into the war zone, ends up accidentally killing this kid.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, he's like, "How's the boy?" Like, he doesn't know. And the character who's like Christopher Nolan Jr. on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the son of what's his name? You know, the guy who owns the yacht. His son.
Yeah,
he's like Christopher Nolan Jr. You know, he's like, oh, he's fine, or he'll be okay. You know, and I just thought, like, what this moment of humanity where, like, yes, he did this bad thing, but, like, why? Why did he do it? He didn't mean to do it,
right?
And you know, that's what really stuck out to me. I found it very gripping, and it held up for me in the second viewing.
Yeah, man, you're making me. I have already kind of wanted to revisit when I saw that it was out now.
Yeah.
It's definitely something I got to go back to.
Give it another look, see what you think. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my number three. What's your number three, Brian?
Number three for me was Baby Driver.
Nice.
And this was, again, this is one of those things where it's like Baby Driver in front of, you know, like, three billboards and all that sort of stuff. But this is my experience with movies this year. And this movie. I don't know, man. I was just really taken with this thing. Like, it was like watching my favorite rock song.
Sure.
You know, on screen. And it just kind of, it had it all for me. I mean, it felt like a rock and roll song. It felt like an awesome ride. And it also had this, I mean, it has fantastic action captured in really fun and inventive ways because it's Edgar Wright. So, of course, obviously. But it also had this sort of fairy tale style story where, I mean, you really want to get down to it. Characters' motivations feel a little slight in some ways, but I feel like that's almost intentional. I mean, it's supposed to be a bit of a heightened reality where it's like, you know, the hero and the princess and the villain and the whatever sort of modern fairy tale action film. And for those, for what they did with those things, I was taken with it. And I did actually, I didn't just want to get to the next action sequence. I was rooting for him to get through the next action sequence because I cared about the guy. And I've seen this movie, I think, I don't know. I know I at least saw it twice. I may have even seen it three times. And I just really enjoy this ride. So Baby Driver for me was number three.
It's a good flick. I'm not going to quibble with that at all. It's,
yeah.
It's a good one.
It's a good one.
So that was your number three. Number two for me is The Last Jedi.
Yay.
We both liked it a lot. I, you know, one thing I remember is you put The Force Awakens on your top 10 list in for 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not do that, only because what I said at the time was because I felt like I needed more before I could say what I thought. Like, it just, it felt like an incomplete story to me. And yet here we are with The Last Jedi, which gives, at least for me, a better sense of where, what this trilogy's intentions are.
Yeah.
And that's why I ended up placing it on my list this year. I found it, my opinion of it grew with each viewing.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd like to see it at least one more time before it leaves theaters, which is certainly not something I say about many movies. It's emotional. It's introspective. It's humorous. It touches all the bases. And yeah, it does Star Wars differently. And some people hate it because of that. I love it because of that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So number two, go ahead.
Number two, here we are. Number two for me was I, Tanya.
Nice.
The Tanya Harding movie, I guess.
Yeah, you were quite effusive about this the last time we talked.
You know, I've seen it twice since. I watched it once and was really taken with it, and then I watched it again with coworkers who hadn't seen it, and I was wondering if it would hold up again for me, and it just does. I mean, this is, I think what's interesting about this movie is it really it aims to do something different, and it knows that we can't, I mean, they're not going to make a straight up hero out of Tanya Harding, because I don't think she is one. But I do think she's slightly misunderstood. And so what they try to do is they're like, look, there's three points of view or several points of view to the story. So we're just going to show you the story through these different points of view. And that's what it does. And it does so in an inventive and sort of hyperkinetic way that I feel like this is a movie where like the style could become obnoxious in some people's hands, but it, I feel like he handled this really well, and I've heard people compare it to like a Martin Scorsese movie, and I think that's kind of, yeah, I totally get that. And and I think what helped too was I had just recently watched the 30 for 30 documentary about this story, Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. And so I knew that all of the stuff that seemed over the top was actually accurate. Right down to the characters and the way they behave. And there's a guy in here who plays the person who was Jeff Galooly's friend who sort of orchestrated the incident. And his name's Sean. He's played by Paul Walter Hauser. Okay. And he is phenomenal. The second time I watched it, I appreciated what he was doing even more. And you think he's almost playing a cartoon character, and then you see footage of this real guy, and you're like, no, he nailed that guy. Like, that is exactly how that guy behaves. And I think Margot Robbie, I would not be surprised at all. Her being nominated for Best Actress, in my opinion, is a shoo-in. But her winning, I think she deserves it, honestly. I mean, she covers a wide range of things and makes someone at times likable and at times despicable and at times desperate. And there's one scene where the world is crashing in on her, and you spend about a minute and a half watching her put makeup on in a mirror. And it's just seeing every single emotion in her face. You know, excitement and tragedy and heartache and all these things. It's breathtaking. And I thought this was a really, really well-made movie, and I enjoyed it a heck of a lot.
I think it's remarkable to me how Margot Robbie has really taken ownership of her own career.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Because you can easily see the scenario where she sort of is stuck in sort of the sex pot role.
Yep.
You could see her being like a going through the same struggles that like Sharon Stone went through in the early 90s, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what Margot Robbie realized early enough in her career is she needs to diversify sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what allows for performances like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's extremely talented. We gave her Best Actress at the San Francisco Critics Awards.
Yeah, I mean, I think completely deserved. I don't know. I think I might have mentioned on this show that I was a little surprised this movie wasn't getting more talk, but I guess I didn't realize that it was in such limited release. I think it still is. It might be opening wider now, and I've talked to more and more people who've seen it and who have enjoyed it. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. And it's just, it's true. I don't know, it handles the sort of black comedy in a way that's interesting and the stakes that are interesting, but it also has these sort of quieter moments where things get a little more serious and dark. And there's like one moment in particular between her and her mother that just like made me gasp, like actually gasp. And the movie gets quiet for about 10 or 15 seconds because the movie's allowing you to gasp. And I just, the balance of all these things, I just thought was really, really impressive.
Yeah, people are definitely talking about it now.
Yeah.
So that was your, what number?
Number two.
That was your number two. Okay, so my number one, Brian, is The Post.
Oh, nice.
Yes. So I've mentioned several times, you get a crusading journalist movie, you have Tom Hanks in the lead role, and you have it directed by Steven Spielberg. Well, it's like you're daring me not to like it, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It by the end, I'm like, oh, you know?
Yeah.
it just works for me. I think it works as a timeless piece of film that is a perfect prequel. It is the Rogue One to All the President's Men's Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so relevant with everything going on. I mean, the fact that we had, like a week ago, the president of the United States sued to prevent the publication of a book that's uncritical, that's critical of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just all of this has happened before and it'll happen again. And I think that's the reason Spielberg made it. And I think that you can't have a greater sort of moral authority than Tom Hanks telling us, right. You know, telling us, hey, this is what's important. You know,
mm-hmm.
The First Amendment is important. I think the importance of journalism, effective journalism in a functioning democracy cannot ever be understated. So I think movies like this are always important.
Yeah, and it also, I was really taken with the fact that it's not a special effects movie. There's no car chases, but it is, you know, it just snaps. And it's really easy to miss what a master Spielberg is and how easy he makes it look.
That's right.
And that's one of the things I really took away from it also, just from a, you know, as a film.
Yep.
Man, all right. So number one.
Hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Let me, I have my prediction.
Oh, yeah.
About what it's going to be.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm wondering, should I tell you what I think it is or should I just think it?
Sure.
I'm going to say Coco.
And you would be correct.
Do I know you, Brian? Do I know you?
I know. This, I actually struggled putting this number one because I was like, really? Is this really number one? And I even thought, is this a movie that I want to watch over and over again? And I'm like, actually, I don't know if it is. But easily, this was the craziest experience I had with a movie in the theater this year. And this is total Brian Hall talking right here. Like this... I don't know the experiences other people had, but it just hit this. And I thought about this, actually, what you said with Ghost Story, where it just made you think about mortality,
right,
and life. And that's what this movie, it just hit me maybe at the right time. And but it's about family and memories and love and passion, following your passions. Which was something obviously that I glommed onto with The Disaster Artist. So that's something I really tend to relate to in stories. But I was just absolutely swept away by Coco. And it's, you know, the story of this boy who really loves music and wants to get into music, but his family forbids it because a family member of theirs, like I believe it's the great grandmother,
yeah,
or grandmother, was sort of spurned by a musician.
Right.
And And then, you know, it's about the Day of the Dead, the celebration of the Day of the Dead. And the boy enters the land of the dead and is able to meet the people that led his family to feel this way. And it's a surprising journey. I mean, it isn't just as simple as then he meets this person and everything was incorrect. And then they da da da. I mean, there's these really sort of surprisingly dark twists and turns that surprised me. And I know some people said that they were able to sort of catch things before they came, but I don't know. I was so enraptured with it that I went with it for all the twists and the turns and the revelations and the realizations. And I think I even said, I mean, I think I openly sobbed
yeah.
twice during this movie. And it really hit a sweet spot and something that meant a lot to me, maybe even just personally this year. I don't even know next year if it would have been my number one, but this year in particular, just the themes of this movie and the journey of this movie just really connected with me. And I found it a really remarkable and rich and rewarding movie that made me reflect on those feelings in my own life and my family and how I feel about, you know, my family members and remembering people and keeping people alive through your memory. And so, to my surprise, Coco was easily the most crazy movie experience I had. I had the highs, the lows, the tears, the laughter. Nice. That's it for me.
Well, there we go. And so that closes out our 2017 favorites.
Yeah.
Not a bad list. So if you haven't seen any of these, folks, you got some movie viewing ahead of you.
Yeah.
But let us know your thoughts. Let us know where you agreed and disagreed.
Yes, I love hearing people's lists and why. So I would love to hear this stuff.
And if you do want to reach out to us, you can email us at moviefilmpodcast@gmail.com or message us at our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviefilmpodcast. You can also find me at my website, zakiescorner.com. That's Z-A-K-I-S corner. It's also my Twitter. That's also my Instagram. You can also find me at the Huffington Post, where my movie reviews go up regularly, as does this show, as does the Nostalgia Theater Show. Brian, anything you want to hype up for our listeners?
Well, I am currently working on a show called Puppy Dog Pals, which airs on Disney and Disney Junior, and I'm super biased, but it's a really fun and adorable show about these two dogs that get into adventures. So I think little kids are really going to like it, and anybody who just loves watching dogs having fun and traveling the world and solving mysteries, I think they're going to enjoy it too. So
there we go.
Check it out.
And that wraps up this episode. We have begun 2018, and we've got lots of fun stuff planned for the weeks and months ahead. So please join us again in a few weeks when we're back with our next episode. And until next time, my name is Zaki Hassan. On behalf of Brian Hall, thanks everybody for listening.
Welcome, friends. It's the Movie Film Podcast. Podcast, enjoy the show. Zaki and